This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. The titles of Gaucher's songs give a sense of what her life has been like. Drag Queens in Limousines is about the people who took her in after she ran away from home. I Drink is about the period in her life when she did. Gaucher was in and out of jail and rehab before she was old enough to vote. Her album, The Foundling, is all about being an adopted child, her search for her birth mother, and the rejection she was met with when she found her. Gaucher's new album, Trouble in Love, is about a relationship that went bad. Mary Gaucher brought her guitar to our studio and played several songs live. Before we hear that session, let's start with a track from Mary Gaucher's new album, Trouble in Love. This song is called When a Woman Goes Cold.
Mary Gaucher, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your music. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. Thank you, Terry.
So this album seems to be a very personal album, very autobiographical, about one particular relationship. And it seems like a kind of odd place to start an interview. But what was so life-changing about this relationship gone bad that we have a whole album of songs about it?
Well, I think that this is the one where Mary finally gets the lesson.
What's the lesson?
I think the lesson is that romantic love will not save me. That hanging my desire for a family and connection on romantic love has not been a successful strategy for me. And I finally get it. That connection is something much deeper and broader than the material that most pop songs are made of. You know, the popular radio is about the first 6 months of love, right, or the first 90 days. So, and I long for real and true connection. It's been the theme of all my songs and my whole life.
You didn't start writing songs until you were in your mid-30s, and that was after you got sober, after giving up hard drugs and alcohol. You'd been working as a chef before you were a songwriter. How did you start gravitating toward music, and what did music mean to you before you started writing music yourself?
Yeah, music and books, I think, were the two things I trusted the most as a child. And I leaned into music really young. Radio used to be good, you know. I'd lay in bed, and those songs spoke to my soul. There was just such a connection between me and so many of those songs on the radio back then. So songs, and especially lyrics, have always been really important to me. I feel like I heard truth there. And as a kid, and as an adult, but especially as a kid, I needed to hear the truth so bad. You know, I grew up in a situation where it felt like an emergency all the time.
Why?
Oh, my father had alcoholism. My mom struggled with, I don't know what to name it, but there was a huge amount of chaos and turbulence, a huge amount of pain in that house. And so I was looking for something that felt like me, you know? Plus, I was adopted, and I think that adoptees are inclined to do that anyway.
To do what?
To look for things in the world that reflect them back to themselves.
So writing songs did that for you?
That's, I think, one of its higher functions for me, yes.
One of your early songs, and which is also one of your best-known songs, is called Drag Queens in Limousines, and it tells the story of how you ended up leaving home when you were a teenager. And I'd like you to perform some of that song for us, and then we'll talk about the circumstances in your life that led to the song.
Okay, sure will. I hated high school. I prayed it would end. The jocks and their girls, it was their world. I didn't fit in. Mama said, baby, that's the best school money can buy. You be strong, hold your head up. Please, Mary, try. So I stole Mama's car on a Sunday, left home for good. Moved in with my friends in the city, in a bad neighborhood. Charles was a dancer, he loved the ballet. Kimmy sold pot, she read Kerouac and Hemingway. And drag queens in limousines, nuns in blue jeans, dreamers with big dreams, all took me in.
Thank you for playing that. That's our guest, Mary Gaucher, performing in our studio, singing her song Drag Queens and Limousines, one of her first songs. So that song is based on your life. You know, part of that song, it takes a surprising turn. Your mother's giving you this advice. She's saying, baby, it's the best school that money can buy. Be strong. Hold your head up. Please, Mary, try. And at that point, I'm thinking, she's praising her mother for her mother's wisdom and advice. But right after that, you say, I stole Mama's car on a Sunday and left home for good. So did you steal your mother's car?
Yeah, I did. I did. And I drove myself to rehab.
Oh, is that where you went?
Yeah.
So she got her car back.
Yeah, I didn't want the car. I wanted out of the house. I drove myself to the Adolescent Chemical Dependency Unit in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
You ended up going to Kansas for a while?
Yeah, they put me in a halfway house in Salina, Kansas.
Oh, they moved you there?
From the rehab, yeah. They didn't send me home. They told me that I had a better chance in the world if I went to a halfway house. So I went to the halfway house, stayed there about a year, left, went back home, ran away from home again, back to the rehab, back to the halfway house, and then I got thrown out of the halfway house. And I was driving cars through a car wash as a job, and I was stealing quarters and nickels and dimes out of the wherever they were falling around in the car. And then it gravitated up towards, I was stealing eight-track tapes, and somebody missed one of their 8-tracks, and I got arrested for that and spent the night in jail. But that was my 18th birthday. Yeah, I spent my 18th birthday in the Salina, Kansas jail cell.
So did drag queens and limousines and nuns in blue jeans take you in?
They did. Drag queens, It's such a strange story, but drag queens taught me how to cook and how to dress. I was wearing, you know, black shirts and purple socks, and I just didn't have it together. I wasn't able to figure out how I wanted to look or how to. I knew that I was androgynous, but I didn't know how to play that out in a clothing selection. And so I don't know. I remember a drag queen showing me how to send a drink to a girl down the bar and smile and wave. I didn't know that's how it was done, you know. It was like a surreal and yet beautiful a childhood, really. I was a kid, you know.
I want you to play another song for
us. Please.
And this is another of your early songs and another well-known song from yours, and it's called I Drink.
Okay. And
do you want to say a little bit about writing it before we hear it?
Yeah. This is a song that I wrote, I think I was about 5 years sober, maybe 4 years sober. And I could have never written this if I didn't get sober. I took it from something I heard somebody say. Somebody said, look, fish swim, birds fly, drunks drink. And if you're uncomfortable not drinking, that's natural. It'd be like asking a fish not to swim or a bird not to fly. And I knew that there was something in there. And I turned it into this. Well, he'd get home at 5:30, fix his drink and sit down in his chair, pick a fight with mama, complain about us kids getting in his hair. At night he'd sit alone and smoke. I'd see his frown behind his lighter's flame. Now that same frown's in my mirror. I've got my daddy's blood inside my veins. Fish swim, birds fly, daddies yell, mamas cry, old men sit and think.
That's Mary Gaucher performing for us one of her early songs called I Drink. And, you know, it's a really good song, and the song defines drinking almost as like an existential condition, you know. And so did you think before you got sober that you would be capable of it?
Of getting sober?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think a lot about getting sober. I got sober out of the blue. I was arrested for drunk driving opening night of a restaurant that I was a partner in. And on the floor of the jail cell, I left my body for probably a millisecond and looked down on myself and saw something pitiful. And it was that moment where the grace of God could enter. Grace, that unmerited gift, I received it. I saw my condition as hopeless. And in that moment of surrender, I became willing to ask for help. And it changed everything. It changed everything. I wasn't asking for help prior to that. I didn't think I needed help.
One of the things that's profoundly influenced your life and your songs is the fact that you were adopted. And how old were you when you found that out?
I always knew I was adopted.
How'd your parents tell you?
I don't remember. They told me when I was a baby.
Mm-hmm. And why do you consider that, like, basic to your identity?
It's fundamental. And it shaped me. Well, I was in the orphanage in St. Vincent de Paul's on Magazine Street in New Orleans until I was almost a year old. I don't think I ever got held by my mama. I don't think I got any mirroring. And so that was completely and utterly traumatic. I think it was trauma from the first breath. And I think I've spent my whole life trying to heal from that trauma. And so it shaped my brain. It was like getting hit with a plank. You know, first breath, plank. Maybe even before, because I in her womb, she didn't want me. I wasn't wanted. I was a shame to her.
Well, tell us something about your mother, your birth mother's circumstances.
Well, I don't know. She won't tell me.
You hired a detective to try to track her down because you didn't know who she was.
Right. I found someone when I was in my mid-40s. A therapist said, either you go find her or I won't be your therapist anymore. She said, it's time, Mary. It's time. And so I found someone who was also an adoptee from St. Vincent. And she's a bit of a search angel who found my birth mother in, like, less than a week. I figured I had a month or two at least, but she called me a week later. She says, okay, you got a pen? And I was driving from New York, and I was in the Bronx on the road. I was like, oh, my God, you found her. I nearly had a heart attack. But I did call her. She didn't respond well. There's not been a reunion. She won't tell me the circumstances. I do know this. She wasn't married. It was the Deep South. It was 61. Back then, that was the most shameful thing that could happen to a woman. And they had an overabundance of babies in this orphanage. There were too many unmarried women having babies. There weren't enough families to adopt them back then.
And that's what you know.
I know that because I went back to there, to St. Vincent's, and there's pictures on the wall of the orphans. It's a guest house now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Gaucher, and her new album is called Trouble and Love. You recently performed at the Opry.
I did,
the Grand Ole Opry. Your first time, your second time?
Well, Marty Stewart brought me to the Opry years and years ago when we were George Bush was president. I'd written a song called Mercy Now. It had an anti-war sentiment. We were building up. We could, you know, everybody could see this is where we're headed. And Marty wanted to make a statement, and he brought me on as his guest during his set. And he told the audience, listen to this girl, I love this song. So that was my first time on the Opry. This last time, a couple weeks ago, the Opry itself invited me on to do my own set, which was really exciting for me.
What did you sing?
I sang Mercy Now again, and the meaning has changed so much now. Now we're looking at a situation that's so different now in Iraq with its collapsing. And it's just a whole nother conversation, but the meaning is different than when I played it when we were building up to a war. And I played another train from the Trouble and Love record.
Maybe that would be a nice way to end with some of the song that ends your new album, Another Train. Do you want to sing some of that? Introduce it for us.
Yeah, sure. This is the hopeful song that I end the record with, and the idea behind it is that there's been a loss. Grief is necessary because I do have a heart, and the sorrow is a blessing because it's transformative. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and when you get towards the end of it, start looking at train stations because sooner or later, there'll be another train. Love will come back, but not idealized romantic love as a savior. Something far deeper and much more meaningful. That's what I'm trying to say. So, I got me an apartment on the east side, 1411 13th Street. I walk on the tracks by Cumberland River, over the bridge, past Lover's Leap. I'm moving on through the pain, through the pain. Way train, another train. I tore a hole in the pocket of the jacket you bought me in that thrift store in Camden Town. Behind the station, you wrapped your arms around me. You built me up. You tore me down. But I'm moving on through the pain, through the pain. Be another train.
Mary Gaucher, it's just been great to talk with you, and I'm so glad you performed for us. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Terry. Thank you.
Mary Gaucher's new album is called Trouble in Love. You'll find a longer version of her Fresh Air interview, which includes a live recording of Gaucher covering a John Prine song, online at freshair.npr.org. Best-selling and award-winning country music artist Miranda Lambert's latest album, Platinum, came out earlier this month and spent its first 2 weeks at the top of Billboard's country albums chart. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the new album continues Lambert's mission to create songs about women who are complex, fun-loving, and assertive.
And imagine a winner holding pink champagne, who still loves her daddy but changes her name. An overachiever, even she don't believe her own game.
Miranda Lambert leads off her enormously entertaining album Platinum with that song, Girls. It's a mini-manifesto of country feminism, nicely complicated by Lambert's cheerful acknowledgement that making a blanket statement about all women is a fool's game, and Miranda is no fool. She began her career opining about everything from domestic violence to smoking and drinking. Now, a superstar at the center of her industry, she's devising new ways to sing about smoking and drinking.
It was one of those times when a real good time felt like a long time ago. It was one of those fires that burned all night and made your blue juice smell like smoke. Hanging with friends, going against our upbringing, smoking and drinking. It was one of those girls and one of those guys who didn't know quite what to do. We were going along with what was going on, saying I think I love you. Think about us now, every time that I go out, smoking and drinking. Smoking and drinking on the weekend, like we did back in the day, smoking and drinking.
Miranda Lambert is joined on that song by another mega-selling country act, Little Big Town, for a ballad with a distinctly nostalgic air. Some of the pleasing tension in Lambert's music increasingly arises from the disparity between the working-class Texas upbringing she's left behind for top-tier country music fame. She doesn't waste our time with false piety for the confinements of small-town life or with complaints about life at the top. Instead, she's found ways to dramatize that disparity with vivid details that can be poignant or, in the case of the title song, rife with puns and self-parody.
My disposition permeates the room when I walk in a place. I'm sorry. By calculation, I'm way too much. Pretentiously, I bitch a bunch, but you bought it. I can't exceed my reputation. A small town girl with compensation. Exploiting all my possibilities. Well, don't you know I blaze a trail? But hell, you can come with me. What doesn't kill you only makes you blinder.
Over the course of this album, Lambert covers a lot of musical ground, from old-timey Western swing to a hard rock stomp duet with Carrie Underwood. She continues her habit of unearthing excellent songs from her precursors, in this case, Tom T. Hall's All That's Left. Yet on the only song here that she wrote all by her lonesome, the brilliant Bathroom Sink, she owns up to a vulnerability that uses the metaphor of applying makeup as a way of covering up flaws that are deeper than skin deep.
I'm at it again with mama. Everybody's so tired of the drama. We're still fighting like I'm 16. And I guess we always will be. She taught me how to pray and drink and how to clean the bathroom.
Another song on this album, Lambert boasts, "You can't step to this backyard swagger." The pose is bold and the language is telling, borrowing from the hip-hop slang that's increasingly infiltrating the country mainstream. Platinum is a collection of very disparate songs that cohere around notions of inclusion and creations of identity. That old-fashioned concept of the self-made man becomes, over the course of Platinum, the chronicle of a self-created woman.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Miranda Lambert's latest album, Platinum. Coming up, we'll talk about the new romantic comedy Obvious Child with the film's director, Gillian Robespierre, and its star, Jenny Slate. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Jenny Slate, star of the new romantic comedy Obvious Child, and Gillian Robespierre, who wrote and directed the film. In Obvious Child, Slate plays a 27-year-old stand-up comic who still doesn't quite think of herself as an adult. After getting drunk and having sex with a guy she just met, she finds out she's pregnant and decides to have an abortion. Not your typical rom-com plot twist. Jenny Slate is a stand-up comic as well as an actress. She's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and has recurring roles on Comedy Central's Kroll Show, NBC's Parks and Recreation, Fox's Bob's Burgers, and the new FX series, Married. Slate voiced the animated shorts Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which she co-wrote with her husband, and adapted into a best-selling children's book. Let's start with a scene from early in Obvious Child. Slate's character, Donna, does stand-up at a bar in Brooklyn at night. But she's just found out her day job is about to end. The bookstore where she's worked for the past 5 years is closing. To make matters worse, her boyfriend just dumped her. After this double dose of bad news, she visits her mother, a university professor played by Polly Draper. They talk over dinner.
You know, an ex-student of mine started a temp agency? They specialize in placing people in the entertainment world.
I'm Professor Duxlass.
You're about to lose your income. You don't seem the least bit concerned.
I'm terrified, Mom. Believe me, I very much am, but I'm not going to work for one of your business school students.
You're almost 30 years old. You still don't know how to do your taxes.
I'm a couple of years away from 30, and nobody knows how to do their taxes.
Have you spoken to your agent about booking any commercial work?
You know, I haven't, because recently she put her entire body into her oven.
Oh, you're never serious.
I will use TurboTax this year, okay?
Hand me the plate.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm in kind of an emotional crisis right now.
I know you're going through some pain right now, but you're always going to be going through something.
I haven't borrowed money from you in months, and I just did that commercial for the organic douche, which is going to be a real boon to my image.
Well, I'm glad you did the douche job. The douche paid well.
Definitely stop saying douche.
There are other things in your life you could afford to be a little more selective about. Your next beau, for example. I'll never forget that brunch when he told us his SAT scores.
Mom, really? A lot of people aren't good test takers.
You were. And now you waste that 780 verbal on telling jokes about having diarrhea in your pants.
That's a scene from Obvious Child. Gillian Robespierre, Jenny Slate, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having us.
Gillian, did you write the part of Donna for Jenny?
Oh, yes.
You were already friends?
We met in 2009 while we were making the short. My collaborators, Karen Main and Anna Bean, and I were looking to cast the role of Donna, and we had not found her yet. So we did what any, like, 25-year-old would do on a Wednesday night, which is go see free comedy. And there Jenny was on stage. She was co-hosting this show called Big Terrific, which was in the back of a record store in Williamsburg. And she was co-hosting an evening with Gabe Liebman and Max Silvestri.
And Gabe Liebman's in your movie.
And Gabe yes. pops up 5 years later in Obvious Child, the feature. And she was just articulating everything that we were thinking in our heads and have been talking about, you know, around our kitchen table or at bars about our bodies. And, like, I, you know, we all looked at each other and we just had to ask Jenny to be in our movie because Donna had the same sort of voice. And we needed somebody who had dramatic range and also comic timing. And up there in her confessional style storytelling comedy, I saw the range in the 10 minutes that Jenny was performing. So we had a friend in common, sent her the script. A couple days later, we were in my apartment drinking beers and smoking cigarettes out the window.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Depending on whose mom's listening.
And, yeah, when I sat down to write the feature, it was 100% for Jenny.
My guests are Gillian Robespierre, the writer and director of Obvious Child, and Jenny Slate, the film's star. Slate plays Donna, a 27-year-old stand-up comic whose career hasn't gone any further than the bar in Brooklyn where she performs her confessional monologues. After spending the night with a guy she just met, she discovers she's pregnant and decides to have an abortion. In this scene, she's performing at the bar. You'll hear her stumble a bit when she sees the guy she slept with walk into the room.
You guys like my singing voice? I just burped into this because I'm an adult woman. I do like being an adult woman. I've always wanted to be that. I've always wanted to have just like a bra and a blouse. And a schedule, like, where I could just, like, be in my house and just be like, oh, my God, I'm running late, you know? Like, always wanted to be able to be on the car phone and be like, okay, Susan, will do. What? Okay. All right. Talk soon. And then just hang up and not worry about, you know, like, why the bathroom smells in a weird way. but I'm not here to talk about car phones. I came here tonight on a very different mission, and that is to say to you that, which is to say to you that I am pregnant. Ooh. Ooh, okay, all right. Testing the waters. I dropped that one down. The second thing
that I would like to say right now out loud, and I'm going to say it out loud right now. Out loud right now. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Just rolling along with this out loud right now. Is that I am going to have an abortion. Okay. Keep breathing. Tomorrow, which is Valentine's Day. So we'll start from there.
Like the character Jenny Slate portrays, Slate does stand-up comedy that is frank and autobiographical. Slate has done a lot of comedy about sexuality and body issues. Gillian Robespierre wrote the part of Donna for Slate after hearing a performance in which Slate talked about discovering sexual feelings as a child. We talked about that in the interview. That part was really funny, but it was also a little too explicit for broadcast. We will have it for you as an extra online. This next part of our conversation refers to the section we couldn't broadcast in which Slate discussed doing stand-up comedy about her early sexual feelings. That really takes, I think, guts to stand on stage and talk about that, especially when people don't know who you are yet. And maybe right. It's easier when people don't know who you are, but it's not like you already have a reputation you can fall back on. And I think until recently, people were really not used to hearing that kind of discussion from women comics on stage. Men, you know, there's a long history of men talking about sexual things on stage.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the way that I speak to my friends. And I always noticed that I felt this sort of zing of excitement and connection with people, and I felt my identity kind of shining when I would speak about my family and growing up, because it did shape who I am as a woman, and it's my way of introducing myself and of sort of laying out all of my imperfections and the little doodads that hang off of my personality that I want to protect, but I'm also maybe a little bit unsure of if they'll be accepted. So I think socially I knew that it worked for me. And then when I graduated from college, Gabe Liedman and I started to be a stand-up duo, and we got on stage together. So that was wonderful for me because we really talked about each other. So first it was him and I discussing me, and then we would discuss him. And so it started that way, and I could tell that it worked. And I don't know. I never was scared. I was more scared of not being able to perform. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned a lot about myself when I started doing stand-up and grew through my 20s. But I just felt like I was working from my nature, and it felt really good. And I was in the alternative comedy scene. I wasn't, like, in clubs and stuff. So that also helped.
In the very opening minute of the movie, when your character is on stage, she's telling jokes about her vagina and her underwear. Now, you're younger than I am. When I was growing up, the word vagina was just like a scary word, like it's a word that you didn't say, you know? And that's changed a lot, I'm glad to say. Did you grow up with any of that, like, you don't say that word? That's a scary word. You don't talk about it. You don't say it.
Not at all. My mom said vagina all the time. She drew me a diagram of, you know, my lady parts, and I believe she laminated it after, because everything was laminated in our house. My bus pass, I grew up in the city, so she would laminate my bus passes, and she would laminate my diagrams of, you know, like, this is your ovaries, this is your uterus, and they're your fallopian tubes. I wish I saved it. But vagina was nothing shameful in my house. And I do remember one conversation where, when I was little, I would only just wear a T-shirt and around the house, you know, and my underwear, obviously. But there was that conversation as a little girl at a certain point, I think maybe it was like fourth grade or fifth grade, where it's like, Gilly, you have to wear shorts now. Mm. Because I would just sit Indian style, vagina out, watching TV. And that conversation, I think, scared me, because that's when I realized that I was growing up, and I don't think I was ready to understand that meant wearing shorts and pants around my house.
So while we're talking about bodies, another thing about the comedy, Jenny, that your character does in the movie has to do with farting. And again, a long history of men who've done jokes about that, not so much women. And I think, you know, that's one of those odd places where there's really been like a double standard where like men joke about it all the time and, you know, perform it even, you know, do it in a performative
right.
way. But for a woman, I think it's just considered this like horrible embarrassment. So, Jenny, do you talk about, have you talked about that in your own stand-up? And then Gillian, I'll ask you about, you know, writing it into the movie.
Yeah, certainly I do talk about my stomach and, you know, all of the different problems that it has. And I think I'm particularly good at making fart noises, and I can do a lot of different ones. And actually, I'm on a cartoon on Fox called Bob's Burgers, and they let me make my own fart noises for that character. That's just a point of pride.
Great.
But, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. dream come true right now to be able to say that. You know, I always thought that farts were funny, and I always thought that they were mine to talk about because they came out of my body. And I think I was aware when I started doing stand-up, especially on my own, that, yeah, I'm getting up on stage, and I'm a woman, and I dress in sort of a typically feminine fashion. You know, I like to wear dresses and skirts, and the attitude that I have is, I'm so excited to introduce myself to you. And I want to be wearing what I would wear to a date or a dinner party. And I guess when I'm up there, maybe I'm imagining a world where my nature is celebrated and my gender is just part of it. And, you know, I talk about farts. It never seemed like a big thing.
So, Jenny, I have a couple of questions for you about your career as a performer. A lot of our listeners will remember you from your brief stay on Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
You were there for one season. And this is a kind of famous story, like your first night on Saturday Night Live, you're doing a sketch, and you accidentally say an expletive. An expletive,
yes.
That there was supposed to be, like, the clean version of? Like, what was the word you were allowed to say on the air?
I was supposed to say frickin', and I said something else.
Right. How did you end up, like, can you take us through what happened? Is it too painful to ask you to do that?
No. In fact, it's not painful at all. It's, if I can be honest, I've just talked about it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I feel, you know, that, like, kind of tugs at me is just, it's just that I don't want the people that I really like and respect from Saturday Night Live to think that 4 years later, when I'm, like, you know, on 4 TV shows and have this movie coming out and I'm a New York Times bestselling author, that I'm talking about this because somehow I think it's, like, the most important thing about myself. Like, but I do understand why people ask, and I don't mean to be disrespectful at all. I just, you know, that's my honest feeling about it, and I would at least like to say that before I, but I don't mind talking about it. I just think I've never said that before part until recently about why I would hope, you know, that soon I can stop talking about it. But hopefully our movie will be successful enough that people will say, like, oh, you're the girl from the, that thing. But anyway.
The abortion rom-com.
But, yeah, it was my childhood dream to be on Saturday Night Live and to be a movie actress. It was really weird for me to make such a giant mistake on my first episode. And in general, I've been, like, you know, really good in school and don't like to make a lot of mistakes, and was just, like, terrified that happened, and was really embarrassing, and I felt like I really let myself down, and I didn't like it in that moment, but everyone was very nice to me, and I think the Saturday Night Live that I wanted to be on was maybe the one from, like, the 70s or something. I don't think I was well suited for the show. I don't know. I think socially everybody was nice, but I think I'm happier out of it, being free and being able to do many different things and being able to take risks.
What was the first door that opened for you after Saturday Night Live?
Well, really what happened was that my husband and I created Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. My husband's name is Dean Fleischer Camp, and he created the little character of Marcel, who's a shell who has one eye and two shoes, and he has a little voice that he talks in, sounds like this. And we made this YouTube thing, and it got millions and millions of views. I think we're at, like, 22 million now. So that was the first thing that happened, was that, even though I was fired, and I was embarrassed by that, and I think, you know, I got fired, like, by reading it on, like, Deadline Hollywood, which was just, like high school, you know, just like, oh my God, you're embarrassed, like, boom, you're just there. But the resounding response to Marcel was, we like this, and it seemed like a lot of people online liked my creative efforts, and it helped me get back up. And really the most important thing that happened to me that year creatively was that my friend Nick Kroll, who has a show called The Kroll Show, which is on Comedy Central, asked me to be in his pilot. And that was really huge for me because, you know, he's one of the funniest people I've ever met. I didn't actually know him that well at the time, and had a fear of being shunned maybe by other comedians because I had gotten fired, which never happened. And no, that was just coming from me. But he asked me to be on the show, and it brought my confidence back to be included, especially with somebody who I respect so much. So that was a huge turning point for me, just personally, having someone say, I have a thing with my name on it. I would like you to be in it. You're not embarrassing.
Jenny Slate stars in the new romantic comedy Obvious Child. Gillian Robespierre wrote and directed the film. There's a funny and very interesting part of the interview in which Slate discusses how she has performed autobiographical material in her stand-up about discovering sexual urges as a child. This part was too explicit for broadcast, but you can listen to it on our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cool.